6, and she and I had spoken, thought it was best to allow her to go through the entire presentation before we get into comments so that people have an opportunity to get a gist of everything that's contained in the committee's recommendations. We had a committee meeting and an AP meeting in May. The chairman of our AP, Peter Hughes, is here today, and other AP members are as well. And so, you know, if issues come up, I'm sure they'd be happy to address any questions that the council might have. And that's all I have for introduction, and we'll turn it back to Deirdre.
Thank you, Mary Beth.
Thank you very much. This presentation is the first of three. It's document 11, if you want to follow along in the paper copy, related to initiating Framework 26 today. A little bit of background. Document number one is actually a draft action plan, and this may be the first draft action plan the council has officially seen following a lot of the work we've done with the regional office and the Science Center on an operating agreement and the Tiger Team. You've heard from the council staff about that a few times. We are trying to, in a kind of clear, transparent way, develop these action plans from the very start to give you a, you know, quick sense in five pages type of thing, what potentially would be in a document, the types of people that would be involved, the level of analyses that would be involved, and we're going to try to keep track of that with detailed timelines and so forth. So this is an action plan. It's a template. We are doing our best on the staff side to make them as consistent as we can, and so this may be something you see more of going forward. I did include an appendix at the back of the action plan that really we'll just be using for today to kind of bring some background information for you. The committee did meet, as Mary Beth mentioned, and they do have four recommendations for additional measures to be included in the framework. So there is some background information about each of those topics in that appendix if you want to have a little more information, but I will go through some of the highlights in this presentation. So back in November, when you set priorities for this framework action, it was pretty small in scope. It was to set the specifications for one fishing year and then default measures for the following year. In addition, at that time, it seemed that it would be appropriate to, in sync, start looking at adjusting potentially Georges Bank scallop access areas in relation to any changes that might go on with the habitat amendment. Since that time, that habitat amendment timeline has shifted. We spent a lot of time talking about this at the last round of advisory panel and committee meetings, looking at different timeline scenarios, and right now it just is very problematic to continue to include consideration of changing any of those Georges Bank access areas in this document, because basically it's coming in line with exactly when the habitat amendment may be under final action, so it really would be pretty close to impossible to consider those types of changes at exactly the same meeting. So you'll see from the committee motions, the suggestion today is to take that out of this framework and instead replace it with a few other ideas. And then in a subsequent action, we would address potentially those changes after some final habitat actions have been taken. So that first motion is the one that's on the screen related to a recommendation to this council to remove consideration of new Georges Bank access areas, take it out of Framework 26, and instead, as you'll see from this motion, the idea would be to initiate a new trailing scallop framework at the same meeting when final action is taken on the habitat amendment, which is potentially going to be in November, but the idea here is that it's not time specific. Whenever that final meeting is and occurs, the suggestion from the committee is to start another scallop action separate from any other specification package we may be working on. So the idea, we had a very long discussion about this, what makes more sense, but the suggestion right now anyway is to not tie it to specifications. So this is the first motion for you to consider today. Moving on, if that passes and the habitat issue comes out of this framework, the suggestion from the committee is to include four new topics. These came up from all different places, and most of them came through the advisory panel, except for the last one was something that was just discussed at the committee level. The first one has to do with the Northern Gulf of Maine management area relating to its interaction with state water fishing. The second one has to do with trying to reconcile the differences between the boundary and seasons for the two turtle-specific measures that are in place for this FMP, which is a turtle chain mat requirement as well as a turtle deflector dredge. If you recall, the boundaries and seasons are different, and this would be a measure to reconcile those differences. The third idea would be related to AMs. You voted yesterday in Groundfish Framework 53 to include potentially a sub-ACL of northern windowpane to the scallop fishery. So this framework would develop those accountability measures if, in fact, the council decides to allocate a sub-ACL to the scallop fishery. In addition, when the advisors were discussing this topic, in their mind, their suggestion was, well, we've been kind of moving toward this idea of having gear modification closures. I'm sorry, not closures, gear modification areas instead of closures. So their suggestion is actually to expand this issue to not just include northern windowpane, but to also revisit the AMs we have in place for Georges Bank and southern New England yellowtail. So this does increase the scope of this measure, but the idea would be that since that time when those were developed, and admittedly they are quite complex and vary, that the idea would be that we could explore using gear modifications instead of closures. Finally, the idea of considering an inshore corridor for vessels to basically declare out of the fishery. This issue came up as days at sea are reducing and so forth, that there would be some sort of inshore corridor where vessels would not be charged days at sea so that they could return to port if they're fishing from distant locations. So I have a few slides of background for all four of these topics, and then I'll basically turn it over, and I think we're taking a break. The first one, the Northern Gulf of Maine issue. As I mentioned, this is summarized within the action plan on page 3 of document number 1. And then there's about 10 pages of background information about recent catches in some of our state water fisheries for the scallop resource, and a little bit of background about some of those different regulations that occur in state waters. The crux of the issue, really, with this one is that once the federal Northern Gulf of Maine TAC is reached, which has not occurred yet since it's been in place, but once it is reached, there is a restriction for all vessels with any federal scallop permit. Once that TAC is reached, no one with a federal scallop permit is allowed to fish within the Northern Gulf of Maine Management Unit, including state waters. And that's the part that has been identified as most problematic right now, potentially. So as we've been hearing at recent meetings, scallop effort and catches are increasing within the Gulf of Maine, especially in state waters. There are some areas offshore as well, but definitely within state waters, catches have been increasing. There's just a bullet here describing that as the times we have talked about the Northern Gulf of Maine, just giving you a general sense, you know, if this is included and it is kept limited, we're trying to, you know, from a PDT perspective, I'm trying to give you a sense of the amount of resources and time that I would expect the PDT to need to work on these related issues. I tried to kind of categorize it as low, medium, or high for all four of these topics. And in general, I kind of, you know, this is very basic, but kind of felt that this one falls in a medium category. It's not super complicated in any way, but it does potentially have, as just from history when we talk about this topic, the potential to kind of expand into other things, and we have over the years heard about other things people would like to adjust about this program, so there's that potential there. So I'm just highlighting that. In terms of what's going on in the area, as some of you know, the Gulf of Maine resource does vary widely historically with sporadic booms and busts. Since Amendment 11, there were roughly 125 Northern Gulf of Maine permits issued for this category of fishing. A smaller percentage of those vessels are actually active. It does vary each year, but it really we're talking about, you know, less than 20 vessels are actively landing with their Northern Gulf of Maine permit. And for the first few years of the program, only about 10 to 15% of the TAC was harvested each year. If you recall, we have a 70,000-pound annual TAC for this region. However, last year, as we discussed at the last framework meeting, that is increasing quickly. And it rose to 60% in the last fishing year, and we've been tracking it this fishing year, and it is already at 20% for this fishing year, which started in March. So clearly there is an increase in effort and an increased risk of this TAC being reached, which would then prevent anyone with a federal scallop permit to participate in state water fisheries after that closure. So we do have a little background information for you in that appendix about the state water resources and fisheries, as I said. Typically, for the state water fisheries, these are winter fisheries, and this does become an issue when you have potentially a TAC that starts in March, and if it's reached before the traditional winter fishery begins, for example, in the state of Maine in December, then really there's effectively no access to that state water fishery if the TAC has been reached for those vessels. In terms of state water fishing within Maine, there has been an increase in reactivated effort. We discussed this when we were looking at the specifications package in the fall. Previously, it was under 250 vessels in the state, but that is increasing a lot of reactivated effort as these resources are recovering inshore. And in 2012, the state saw about 400 vessels participating in the fishery. Catch last year for the state of Maine was 400,000 pounds, which is an increase from what it was several years ago, and certainly when we were developing Amendment 11 and Amendment 15. Massachusetts as well has a developed management program, not as extensive and involved as the state of Maine is quite an aggressive program that they have in state waters. But Massachusetts as well does have a pretty developed management program as well. There are many, much fewer vessels that are active in Massachusetts, but their landings in the last few years have been in the ballpark of 100 to 200,000 pounds each year. So finally, this is the motion from the committee. It, on purpose, is pretty specific and doesn't just say, you know, look at this issue in general to try to address the fact that we want to keep this probably limited in scope. But the suggestion specifically is for the Northern Gulf of Maine, if you have a federal Northern Gulf of Maine permit or an incidental catch permit, those two types, if the TAC is reached, you would be able to continue fishing in state waters after the federal TAC has been reached. The committee did clarify that that should not be the case for vessels with either an IFQ permit or a limited access permit. So we can get into that a little bit more after the break if you'd like, but that was specifically included as a way to potentially reduce the scope of this action. Moving to the second topic, this is related to turtles. Again, summary of the issue is on pages 3 and 4 of the action plan, and then there's a couple pages in the appendix as well. Very quickly, we have two turtle measures in place, and they are not consistent spatially or temporally. The council has requested the agency look at this issue before. We drafted a letter requested by the scallop committee and the full council to have the agency actually go and do this under their authorities. And the regional office recently wrote us back. Both of those correspondence are in your documents. Document 8C includes that correspondence. And basically the regional office came back and they had some internal meetings and they are recommending an alternative way forward to include in this framework, basically using the turtle dredge boundary but using the turtle chain season as a way to try to keep the conservation neutrality of these two turtle measures together. In terms of what, you know, my analysis quickly of what this would mean for PDT resources, generally whenever we talk about turtles, I get a little nervous that it's going to take a lot of time and add controversy. In this case, the regional office has stepped up and said that they will provide additional resources on the PDT to help complete this work. So I'm kind of categorizing this one as low. A lot of the work has been done already in terms of analysis we did for the turtle dredge action in Framework 23. So this one I'm kind of categorizing as low. This is the turtle dredge on the left, if you're not familiar. Turtle dredge on the top is larger openings for the turtles to escape and more bars within the bale to prevent the turtle from getting in the dredge. And it's hard to see, but there's a turtle chain on top of the dredge to help prevent turtles from actually getting into the bag while it's fishing and coming up to the surface. The issue with the boundaries is on the right. So the area in beige is where the turtle dredge is required, the turtle deflector dredge. So that's for the months of May through October in that beige area. But then the hatched region, which extends further east and has sort of a latitude boundary instead, that's the turtle chain boundary. and that one is for a month longer. So the industry has come to the council through the advisory panel, brought this up a few times, requesting that these become consistent, and that's the second issue, and here's the motion. And the idea here is not that we would look at a whole range of different alternatives, but keep it pretty focused to one that would make them consistent. We're not looking to revisit either of these, you know, from start to finish. Moving on to issue number three, this has to do with AMs. Again, a quick summary of this issue is on page 4 of the action plan and a bunch of background in the appendix as well. I already kind of mentioned this, but the groundfish framework is considering a sub-ACL for northern windowpane, so we would include that, and the advisors suggest expanding that to kind of revisit the work we did over the last few years for yellowtail. In terms of a kind of quick guess at what this would mean in terms of PDT resources, I categorize this one as medium. Again, we did a lot of work in the last framework about AMs. Some input from the council was it was maybe a little overboard. So we do have a good foundation for how we would approach looking at gear modification areas for northern windowpane, but we would, you know, still need to gather quite a bit of observer data and so forth, and especially expanding it to yellowtail, we would have to put some analysis together at a minimum to compare how the gear modifications would compare to the seasonal closures we have in place already. So I'm kind of putting this one in a medium category. In terms of a little bit of background, this is some information about windowpane. The indices for windowpane are based on the fall survey, and you know the last assessment, from what I understand, is that the stock's basically at 29% of BMSY, so it is overfished, and overfishing was deemed to be occurring. The possession of windowpane is prohibited, and stocks are not allocated to the directed fishery in the north. There are no sub-ACLs at this point, so the groundfish fishery is 100% accountable for any of overages that may occur with that ACL. In the south, as you probably know, the scallop fishery does already have a sub-ACL, and it's roughly 36% of the total. So this issue, I think, probably mostly surfaced coming up out of the groundfish plan that in 2014, AMs were in fact implemented for the groundfish fishery due to overages of both windowpane stocks from 2012 catches. So this is just a little information. We don't have to really go through it, but this is just a little more background about the issue specifically for the scallop fishery catching a decent portion of the total for northern windowpane stock as well. So the issue that AMs, I think, really were implemented has kind of brought this to light, and you know the reason it's been highlighted, and now we would be developing AMs in the scallop plan. So finally, again, a little more background from the groundfish perspective about why this is important to look at. Most likely, again, in the interest of trying to keep things kind of streamlined, we most likely would just be looking at, for the most part, gear modifications similar to the one we just passed for the southern stock. And just as a reminder, we do have proactive and reactive measures that were adopted last year for the southern windowpane stock, and most likely we would be looking at probably pretty similar measures for this one, which include reducing the number of rings in the apron of the dredge and changing the hanging ratio to enhance fish escapement. Really quickly, this was a picture of the dredge showing the two different elements of the gear modification AM, including that shorter apron on the bottom, bringing that to, it would have to be 5 rows or less, and then the wider hanging ratio. And these do have pretty decent reductions in flatfish bycatch for all flatfish species. So the place where this probably is going to take more work is looking at the yellowtail issue again. And we do have a very complex program in place. There are 3 different AM areas for the scallop fishery if AMs are triggered. They are different depending on the permit type you have or the gear type that you have. And it almost, as you can see in the documents, takes 2 pages just to explain them. So they are pretty complicated. So when the advisors were suggesting this originally, they were expressing concerns about the complexity. As always, they are not in favor of area closures for those unintended potential impacts. So again, the suggestion was to kind of look at gear instead. That's probably all I have for background. Here's the committee motion, again, to address all three stocks and looking at those AMs again. Finally, the VMS corridor issue. Summary of the issues on page 4 of the action plan, and there is some, you know, 10 pages or so of background in the appendix about basically catches by state and dealer, home port state, and so forth. And as we've seen, we are definitely seeing a trend that more and more vessels are landing near their primary ports, near primary fishing grounds versus their home ports because of the cost of fuel and the days at sea are being reduced further and further each year. So it is just too expensive to spend steaming time and being charged days at sea to get back to a home port in some cases. So more and more vessels are choosing to land closer to where they're fishing to reduce those charges of days at sea. And this, again, most likely having negative impacts on distant ports and communities. So the suggestion from the committee level was to consider a corridor from around Montauk to Cape Henry that would allow vessels to basically get off the clock and not be charged for steaming. And then in terms of an assessment of the work involved here, again, it's pretty basic. This one I did bump up to high, mostly just because right now I do not have within our own PDT. This I imagine, is going to take some pretty serious investigating into VMS data on an individual vessel level and potentially going back a bunch of years to really look at changes and trends and so forth. And I just don't have people on the PDT right now that could really just do this on day one. So we'd have to be looking outside of our plan development team. So that's kind of why I was bumping this one up to high. And just the issue of it having potentially different impacts on different states and different ports, just I think it could suck up some discussion time. So that's why I kind of bumped this one up to high. In terms of a VMS corridor background, there's some interesting information about the number of vessels home ported in different places. And if you look at those tables and data, you'll definitely see some vessels are definitely declining in ports like Newport News and Norfolk, Virginia. The number of vessels home ported in those places have declined over time in the last 10 years. Some have increased, however, and a lot of this just, you know, I'm sure it's just a lot of business changes and people changing their business plans and so forth. In terms of scallop catch by home ported states, Virginia has always been about 12% of the total in terms of the home ported vessels, and North Carolina 9%. However, it's a very different story when you look at landings by dealer state. Instead of home ported vessel, where the vessels are actually landing, the product is very different. And this is hard to see on the screen, but hopefully you can see on your PowerPoint slides. This is basically revenue by landed dealer state that we got from ASMFC. And it's pretty obvious, you know, the state of Massachusetts has always been the primary state in terms of landed catch. Oh, this is the last 10 years or so. And it's bounced around 50%. And that has started to creep up from 50%. And now it's over 70% in the last year, 2012. In terms of New Jersey, you do see in the opposite direction, it's kind of been around 20 to 25%. And that's been a steady decrease in terms of where the product is being landed. Similarly, Virginia, again, was around 15 to 20%, but, you know, with some of these changes and where the resource has been more recently, being on Georgia's Bank and this days at sea issue, a lot more of the product is being landed outside of Virginia. So you can see these data support the discussion that the committee had about this issue. So this is just in, you know, if we get into specifics today, I wanted to have a figure available that has basically a plot of the last 5 years of limited access scallop fishing locations compared with a couple different bathymetry lines as well as the state water line, but to give you a sense of where a potential corridor could be developed between Montauk and Cape Henry. Obviously, the PDT, if this is adopted, would do a lot more work with the industry to kind of design what this potentially would look like. But the committee was very upfront in recognizing that you know, measures should be included to prevent abuse of the Days at Sea system for vessels to come inside of this corridor and shuck at sea, for example, and try to, you know, beat the system. So there were specific suggestions from the beginning about ways to help prevent that in terms of basically once you cross it, you need to return to port and offload your catch, as well as a whole list of other ideas as well. The committee did already talk about the potential implications that this could have on Days at Sea allocations. Obviously, if you take out the steaming time that's, you know, has been going on for vessels since the beginning of the Days at Sea system, the catch rates per day are going to change when you remove that from the equation. So that's where what the PDT would be looking into and determining whether some sort of adjustment would need to be made to account for that change. So finally, this is the motion related to this issue and the request for us to analyze it further with some specific suggestions about measures that could be included to prevent any abuse of the Days at Sea system. I think that's all I have.
Thank you for your report, Deirdre. Mary Beth, do you have any comments or guidance before we take a break?
No, I think we're good. Come back with questions. I'm sure some people have some. Might take a little bit of time. So.
Okay, thanks. Let's take a 10-minute break.
Chairman, and so before we ask questions of Deirdre on her presentation, I thought it was perhaps a good idea just to frame the discussion a little bit. And the council approved for this particular framework, specifications, and consideration of access area boundaries for Georges Bank, and that's tied to habitat. So we have one motion from the committee on that particular issue. And then we have a list that Deirdre has presented to us on other items that the committee has recommended that we include in the framework. And so I would just remind people that, you know, there are some concerns about the number on the list, and Deirdre has in her presentation mentioned the, you know, how much work she thought this would be for the PDT. And if you look on page 4 of her presentation, she has the list of items, the four. Number 1 is medium, number 2 is low, number 3 is medium, and 4 is high. So that's where we're at, and I think that, you know, if people have questions, you might want to just keep that in mind.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Questions on the presentation from the council? Tom.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Dee, I forget, is the do all the boats in the Northern Gulf of Maine with Northern Gulf of Maine permits have VMS? Is that a requirement?
Yes.
Okay. So with that in mind, so what those boats would be asking to do, as I understand it, is just to be able to fish in state waters after the federal waters was closed, but they all have a VMS? All right. Thanks.
Other questions on the presentation? Seeing none, any questions from the audience on the presentation? Seeing none, back to you, Mary Beth.
So I was surprised that that went so quickly, but that's fine.
Deirdre did such a great job.
That's exactly what I said. It's the break, yeah.
So on behalf of the committee, we have a motion that Framework 26 should not address new Georges Bank scallop access areas. After the council takes final action on the EFH omnibus amendment, the council should initiate a new scallop action to consider modifications to Georges Bank scallop access areas. This framework would be standalone and not tied to scallop specifications. And I would just note that this motion does not tie the hands of the council on future actions. It does mean that when we take action on the EFH amendment, that there would be a consideration at that point to initiate this framework. And that is a committee motion.
Committee motion that doesn't need a second. Are there any comments from the audience? Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. We support the motion, and we are concerned about the need to rapidly move with scallop access areas once the habitat decisions are made. So the industry's PUMA team will be developing access area options on the side, working with our academic and Northeast Science Center partners. So it doesn't put a workload on the council process, but is where we'll be ready to hit the ground running at the time that the council starts the access area framework. So,
are there any other comments from the audience? Are you the Puma Grand Puba? Seeing none, back to the council. Are any comments from the council? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's the last day here. We can't count. Motion carries 17-0. 16-0, excuse me. Mary Beth.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to our list of items that the committee recommends are included in this framework. I'll make a motion on behalf of the committee that we include measures to address fishing in state waters by vessels with federal Northern Gulf of Maine and incidental permits after the federal Northern Gulf of Maine hard tack is reached.
Committee motion does need a second. Comments from the audience? Alex.
I just want to say thanks for addressing it, or attempting to.
Could you state your name? And
oh, sorry. Alex Todd, Chebig Island. Since 90, I've been an active participant in the state fishery, and we've gone through all kinds of shortening of the season, daily limits, closed areas, all kinds of things. And it's a healthy fishery, and it's hugely important to my yearly income. And for the first time this year, the Northern Gulf of Maine thing's been important to me. But to close me out of the state fishery because the federal tack is reached and the state fishery is more healthy seems odd to me. I think the 125 permits that are in the Northern Gulf of Maine, I think only 34 of them ish are Maine permits. So, hypothetically, if it isn't changed, only 34 people will be shut out of the Maine fishery that's now up to, like, 500-and-something participants. I lose track of what I was going to say. But thanks for attempting to fix it. Any questions?
No, thank you. Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Hatch, advisor to the Scallop Committee. Thank you for addressing this. I hope we can move it along. As most of you know, I'm pretty passionate about the Gulf of Maine. I think this is a first step towards developing our fishery back that we lost in 94. And I hope that we can move this along, and I look forward to addressing the next process that we'll need to develop Gulf of Maine scallop fishery. Thank you.
Bill.
Yeah, I'm Bill Anderson. I'm from Trescott, Maine. I'm way down east, almost in Canada. And I do hold a, you know, Gulf of Maine permit. I've never fished in federal waters in the Gulf of Maine. I hold it as an option. What's put food on the table is lobsters. I've done other fisheries, and, you know, I've scalloped. And I, you know, now that we're rebuilding the fishery, scallop is becoming a more important part of my income. We're seeing some good signs in what we're doing, and, you know, we're continuing to tune what we're doing. We've rebuilt some areas, and then we've overfished them a little bit, and other areas are looking good and improving, and we're kind of changing and tuning our systems, you know, and hoping to really rebuild the main fishery to where it should be. We have a lot of potential scallop bottom, and we have some small areas, and we hope to make those areas grow into larger areas of scallops. But anyway, to have me, a federal permit holder, not be able to fish in state waters just because you've reached the tack in federal waters doesn't make any sense to me at all. It's almost puts me in a small pool of disadvantaged people at that point. So I'd appreciate it if you'd change this to, you know, I understand you need to have a tack for the Northern Gulf of Maine, and it's possible that I may start to participate in the Northern Gulf of Maine if I, you know, lobsters, they're talking about a decline. And so I built a new 50-foot vessel just a few years ago, and I'm just gradually exploring my other options with that as time goes on. So, you know, if things are improving in the Northern Gulf of Maine and there's something out there to fish for, I'll probably be out, you know, participating in that as well. But the wintertime scalloping is in state waters is very important to all of us that hold federal permits that are active in the state waters. So anyway, thank you for considering changing this.
Tad. Tad Miller.
Name's Tad Miller, Tenants Harbor, Maine. Real name's Ira, by the way. I just want to thank you guys for addressing this. The state, excuse me, the state waters fishery is improving, has been for the last few years, and I think part of the key to this is, you know, we need to have access. We need to have versatility. Like, that's the strength of a small boat fleet. That's been what we've been losing for years now. I view this as being a very important piece of the puzzle for any small boat fishery to have another tool in the toolbox. I think that, you know, to take that away simply because of the tack and the two, you know, I don't think there's any conclusion that, you know, of how one interacts with the other. You know, we've rebuilt the state fishery, and I think things are looking up. So anyway, hopefully you'll follow through with this and not take away our options. I think that's number one thing for me, and I think any other permit holders. Thank you.
Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Martens with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. We have a lot of fishermen who have started to rely on both the Northern Gulf of Maine fishery and the state waters fishery, especially in the winter after we've lost some of the shrimp fishery. They really rely on this to kind of make up some of that gap in the income, and we don't want to be limiting that. At the and we have a number of fishermen in the room today who want to talk about this, but also who aren't able to make it because they're out fishing. So it's really important that we move this forward. The only question that I do have on this is what the timing would look like. And I'd love to hear a little discussion, maybe not right now, but at some point as we're looking at this coming winter and if this is something that would be able to be in place for this season. So thank you.
Question.
Good morning. My name is Kristen Porter. I'm a fisherman from Cutler, Maine. I hold the Northern Gulf of Maine permit, and I want to thank you guys for addressing this problem that's come up. The gentleman that were before me here, I kind of have the same feeling. But the other thing that they didn't say is that, you know, our fishery probably 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, was at its lowest point, and we were down to around 100 fishermen. And these guys with the Northern Gulf of Maine permits, those are the guys that were there. And we took our sacrifices, and we've been, you know, trying new things, and they seem to be working. And now it seems like when a lot of people have jumped in the fishery, and now that scallops are coming back, we, the ones that were there to start with, may not be able to go back and reap the benefits of what, you know, what we've done. So that, and I understand that, you know, that there are issues with getting this moved forward quickly, but, and I know there are also issues, you know, with the Gulf of Maine fishery as a whole, but I think this is the one that needs to be addressed in the short term, and if we could do that, you know, with this, in this framework, would be great, and discuss other things later on. And the state has done a great job of working with us and getting a fishery back, so, you know, what we take out or don't take out if we're not there is going to get taken anyway. So, anyway, thank you for your time.
Are there any other comments from the audience? Jim.
My name is Jim Watton. I'm a Northern Gulf of Maine permit holder from Friendship. I want to thank the chairman. I want to thank the board for tackling this issue and just ask. I'm not going to repeat everything that they've said. I agree with everything they've said. I just ask you to move forward with this, address it, and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the audience? Trish.
Good morning. My name is Trish DeGraff, and I'm the Marine Resource Management Coordinator for the Scallop Resource for the state of Maine. I also serve with Deirdre Bulkey here on the Scallop PDT, representing Maine on that PDT and helping with Northern Gulf of Maine issues as well as state water issues. I do want to support the fishermen that came up here to speak to you earlier today. Our fishery has undergone a very rigorous and ambitious rebuilding program, and the proof is in the pudding. We do have the resource. It is on a rebound. We've had our most recent year in 2013 is the highest landings in the last 10 years and the highest value in the last 15. Our most recent season is looking like it's going to surpass that, and it has mostly been born on the conservation measures that the industry members that have come here today to talk to you about have really borne those measures and brought the fishery back through a number of different avenues, either conservation through closures, lowering the limit, reducing the season. There's a number of different conservation measures that Deirdre outlined in her report for you. The one point that I wanted to make is that the scallops within state waters are not accounted or taken into consideration for the overall TAC for the Northern Gulf of Maine. Therefore, when the TAC is met and state water fishery still continues to undergo, I feel it's unfairly burdensome to the members of our fishery that hold Northern Gulf of Maine permits from being able to participate in that fishery. Our overall fishery is managed by a trigger where if we have information that indicates that the resource is being depleted further than 30%, we do have the ability to close and manage and put in management actions to control that effort. So the fishery will continue. However, if this restriction is not removed, the members of our fishery that were really at the core of rebuilding it would have to sit on the sidelines and not be able to participate. So I would ask that you just consider this motion moving forward, and also let me know if you have any questions about the state waters fishery. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. David.
Massachusetts certainly has an interest in the Northern Gulf of Maine because of the strange location of the boundary that designates the Northern Gulf of Maine that goes through Boston Harbor and therefore includes waters off of Gloucester, Ipswich Bay, state waters, of course, in Ipswich Bay, adjacent federal waters, I point the council to Figure 1 in the document, the action plan, where you can see the locations of the fishery, state waters of Maine, off of Massachusetts, state and federal waters. So clearly we have an interest in the northern Gulf of Maine, and we have an interest in supporting the council's efforts to deal with scallop management in the northern Gulf of Maine. And for that reason, we implemented in 2013 a suite of measures to complement the New England Council's efforts to deal with that particular area. So we're concerned about effort inside state waters permit only, and, of course, those of the Northern Gulf of Maine permit. We're also concerned, of course, about effort off of Provincetown. You take a look at that figure again, you can see a cluster of effort in federal waters and state waters. So we're concerned about shifting of effort back and forth, and we're dealing with that through our state regulations. However, in looking at the motion that I supported at the committee meeting, it appears to me, and it also occurred to my staff, that we can make this motion a little bit cleaner, a little bit more specific, and consistent with the intent to deal with the northern Gulf of Maine areas. So I would make a motion to amend, and that would be to strike the words "or incidental" after northern Gulf of Maine, and then to strike the words "participate in state-only fisheries" and put in its place "harvest scallops in state waters portion of the northern Gulf of Maine." So we're very specific as to what state waters we're talking about. Right now it just says state-only fisheries. It doesn't really say scallops. It doesn't really say where. I think we should be specific and consistent. So let's reference northern Gulf of Maine. So it would read, "Vessels that have a federal northern Gulf of Maine permit as well as a state scallop permit should be able to harvest scallops in state in the state waters portion of the northern Gulf of Maine."
Is there a second on the motion to amend? Seconded by Mary Beth. Let's get it up on the board. Then I have Ellen and Vincent and Mike and Frank.
Actually, Terry, I was about to ask Dave Pierce if there were any state regulations that needed to be changed in order to utilize this, and I think he just answered my question.
Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was prepared to ask a question about the time frame before the motion, so I'm not going to speak on the motion to amend, but I was just asked a question on the time frame for the framework that Ben was mentioning about. Is this something that we're going to be doing within a year, or is this going to be a longer process?
Mary Beth?
So implementation of this framework is likely to be in May of 2015, so it would not provide any relief for the winter fishery that's coming this year, and we don't really have the ability to take an action on that. It's in the framework. You can't speed it up anymore. I mean, primarily this is a spec package for scallops.
Mike?
Yeah, I do want to express one reservation or a reservation about this, and that it basically brings back some very bad memories about state water loopholes in terms of federal regulations that were very, very prevalent some years ago. So I do get nervous about these sort of things that basically say once you fulfill that basically create an inconsistency between the state the state regulations and the federal regulations. However, in this case, I'll support the amendment as well as the main motion because we're basically asking the PDT to explore all the options and evaluate these things. I'm also, while I am concerned about this as a general matter, I'm not terribly concerned about it in this particular case given the strength of the regulations that are in place in the state of Maine and the reality that, in fact, this is somewhat the tail wagging the dog in that the state fishery is much larger than the offshore fishery. But I did want to, as a general point, express that we need to be concerned about creating loopholes to the federal fisheries management. Thank you.
Frank.
Yes, thank you. I think Mike had a lot of my concerns there. But I'm also concerned that this is the only fishery that we do this in. I think everywhere else it's the most restrictive measure if you have a federal permit. And I'll support this to have the PD to look at it, but I'm very concerned on the precedent that we'd be setting for other fisheries.
Other comments? Tom?
Yeah, and just following up on those points, the reason I asked about VMS, I think a lot of those loopholes that Dr. Sissonwine was referring to are because of, you know, a lack of the ability to enforce that line, and all of a sudden state waters start to creep out. But, you know, if all these vessels have VMS, and I think that line's enforceable, and it provides, you know, additional alternatives to sustainably harvest scallops throughout the year, I can get on board with that, and I think we should move this forward.
Vincent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand some of the concerns that have been raised here, but actually they're two real separate fisheries. The tax do not intertwine. The state landings do not go into the federal attack, and it's like a whole different stock area, I guess is a great way to explain it. And when we sign out on our VMS, it is a state only. You press right in, says state exempted right there, and we have different dredge configurations in state waters also. So it's not like, you know, the least restrictive, because it's two intertwined fisheries that operate inside and outside the 3 mile mark. It's either a state only or a federal fishery.
Further comments on the motion to amend? Dieter.
Thank you. I just had a question about the motion, David. When you strike incidental, is it your intent then by striking that if a vessel has a federal incidental scallop permit as well as a state scallop permit, by striking that, they then, if the Northern Gulf of Maine hard tack is reached, they would be prohibited from fishing in state waters? This is removing them from that ability to participate in the state scallop fishery.
Yes.
Okay.
Are there any further comments? Seeing none, those support the motion to amend, please indicate so. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Motion carries 16-0. Same sign on the main motion as amended. Motion carries 16-0. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on, and I will note, you know, if people are looking for further information, document one, which David referred to in his discussion, the next item is on page 111 in that document, and it is about the gear requirements. So the motion on behalf of the committee is to include measures in this framework to make the turtle chain mat and the turtle dredge deflector requirements consistent.
Committee motion does need a second. Comments from the audience? Peter.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Council. My name is Peter Hughes with Atlantic Cape Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey. We, as the chair of the AP, we had considerable discussion in regards to this, in that we want to make clear consistencies within our fisheries management plan. And this was one of the inconsistent measures that was in there that we are trying to correct. You know, some of you are boat owners or vessel owners yourself. Some of you are captains and have been out to sea. You know, you almost need a secretary out there to go through all the rules and regulations that you have to be observant of. And this is just one that there's a north-south boundary and there's an east-west boundary, and we're just trying to make it consistent within the fishery management plan, and also extend the season an additional month based on advice we had received from NIMS. So I support this motion, and the AP supported this motion. Thank you.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smallwitz. Support the motion. Think it's a good idea. There was, in the letter from GARFO, a mention of increased monitoring associated with this. It was a small paragraph towards the end. I was just wondering what the regional office is going to be doing.
Uh,
I'll need to get back to you on that, Ron. I know that PRD staff did mention that in their letter, but I don't think we had any further discussions at the committee level about that. So,
any further comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. Seeing none, those support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Motion carries 16-0. Mary Beth.
So moving on, committee motion that we include in framework 26 alternatives to modify the existing closure AMs in place for Georges Bank in southern New England. And if you keep moving it around, I can't read it. Yellowtail flounder, as well as develop new AMs for potential sub-ACL under consideration in groundfish framework 53 for northern windowpane flounder. Alternatives would likely include reactive gear modification AMs consistent with the AM approved for southern windowpane AM framework 25 and proactive AMs to limit the number of rings in the apron. And information on this can be found on page 114.
Committee motion doesn't need a second. Are there any comments from the audience? Ron?
Ron Smallis, Fisheries Survival Fund. We strongly support this. We believe that the gear strategies is the best way to go, especially on Georges Bank, where there's all sorts of overlapping proposals for closures and seasonal closures for a whole host of reasons. The gear will reduce the bycatch of windowpane and yellowtail and the other flatfish species, which have different seasons. So if you start patching a network of seasonal closures to as AMs for each of those species, you end up with a total mess, while a single gear regulation could solve the whole problem.
Peter.
Thank you. I completely support what Ron's comments were. Peter Hughes, Atlantic Cape Fisheries. And again, this is consistency. Consistency throughout the fishery management plan. We have one measure for yellowtail over here that is inconsistent with the measure for windowpane flounder. So let's get on board and make both of these flatfish species consistent within the fishery management plan through gear technology versus time and area closures. Time and area closures are very restrictive, and they're may not be germane to the season that we're confined from the area, or they may really impede the fishery. So we support the gear considerations and gear modifications that are here, and do not support area closures in this. And it's all about consistency within the fishery management plan. Thank you.
Are there any other comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. Frank.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The timing of this, framework 53, best case scenario would be May 1st of next year. And we're developing, or the committee is going to develop accountability measures for something for March 1st without knowing. Have they discussed that?
Mary Beth?
We didn't really have a lot of discussion about the timing and interaction with Framework 53, and I guess I'd rather defer to Deidre on this.
Okay.
Certainly, Frank, we could wait and not develop these now until we know that there's a sub-ACL. And we did discuss that a little bit at the PDT level as well, that, we're going to spend time developing stuff before we even know if it's going that way. But on the flip side of that, last year we had a sub-ACL, and then the scallop fishery didn't develop AMs until a trailing action a year later. So you kind of pick whatever you think is the better approach. This way, if a sub-ACL is selected for the scallop fishery, you have those AMs in place right away. Granted, they are not most likely going to be in season or that type of thing. So if there's a sub-ACL, it wouldn't be implemented until 2015. And our AMs, this framework would most likely, best case scenario, be implemented May 1st as well. So they are pretty in line, and if anything, this is ahead of the game because we would have those AMs on the books before the sub-ACL is even adopted, or together, same time. The other thing I was going to mention, it is related, if you don't mind. I failed to mention during the presentation, but this is in terms of integration with the groundfish plan and so forth. We will, as we did last year, need to work with the groundfish PDT on this issue at some point. Their plate is obviously very full, and as it always is, and so we will struggle, as we have before, to fit that in and need to show this work to the groundfish PDT, work with them in terms of those impacts of area closures versus these gear restrictions. We have done that kind of work in the last few groundfish frameworks, but again, we will have to definitely, at a minimum, work with the groundfish PDT at some level to kind of bring those things and make sure they're on board with anything that we develop, and maybe even bring it to the groundfish committee.
Tom.
I just had a question, and perhaps it's for Deirdre, and maybe it came up at the committee, but what percentage of the fleet is currently fishing gear that will avoid all or a significant chunk of their flatfish bycatch?
Which portion of the fleet is using voluntarily this gear that we're talking about? I don't have a percentage or knowledge of that. We do have, in the last framework, we looked at how many vessels from observer data are, you know, the numbers of rings that they're using in their aprons. And there definitely are some vessels already using fewer rings, but it's not to the level that, you know, everybody's doing this already, if that's your question.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if everybody knows of gear that would eliminate flounder bycatch, it seems like there should be some good reason why we're not currently fishing that gear. I mean, I support this approach, but if everybody's got the answer as to how to avoid catching windowpane and yellowtail flounder, maybe we should be fishing it now. I don't know if there's a reason why that isn't currently the case.
Sorry, just to continue, if it's okay, and maybe the industry would be able to speak better to it. I think some vessels are proactively looking into this and doing that, but there is a loss of scallops associated with this gear. It's, you know, estimated to be around 10%, so it's, you know, not minuscule. So there is a loss of scallops, so it's maybe why you're not seeing everyone just using it anyway.
To this point, Ron?
Because it's currently illegal. You're not allowed to fish gear with less than seven rings.
Tom.
Just to follow up on that, and yet some people are. I guess it seems inconsistent. So some people are voluntarily and illegally using the gear?
The hanging ratio. Sorry, there's a lot of...
Okay. Other comments from the council? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Motion carries 16-0. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have one final motion for this framework. And so I move on behalf of the committee to request there be an analysis in this framework of an inshore transit corridor option with requirements that vessels in the corridor must stow their gear, and vessels entering the corridor are required to return to port and offload their catch while declared out of the fishery in the transit corridor. And I can't read the rest. Transit time would not count against the days at sea VMS clock. At a minimum, the inshore transit corridor should extend from Cape Henry to Montauk at an adequate distance from shore to facilitate safe navigation.
Committee motion that doesn't need a second, or the comments from the audience? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. I'm Jeff Kalin from Lunds Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey, and member of the Scholar Committee and the seconder of this motion. And I think this is an issue that will benefit not only Virginia or New Jersey or mid-Atlantic states. It's clearly something that I think can benefit the entire fleet. And it's an issue that has come up over the years. I think I've only been involved in the scallop fishery for a few years. We have both full-time and part-time permits. So I think this is something that definitely should be analyzed. There's some concern about the impact on the days at sea calculations, and we don't really know what that would be at this point in time. I can't, in my small mind, really reflect a big problem here, but this is something that I think we should analyze, and I appreciate the council's support for the motion. Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Hughes, Atlantic Cape Fisheries. I agree with many of Jeff's comments that this is going to require a considerable amount of analysis. Unfortunately, as chair of the AP, this was not a topic that came up during any of the AP's meeting, and it came up at committee when most of the AP had already departed to go home. So most of the stakeholders, all of the stakeholders, with the exception of a few, on the AP did not have the this information in front of us, nor did we were we able to have a discussion on it. I do think that it is something that should be discussed and analyzed, but I'm not for it and I'm not against it at this time. I just wanted to make those points clear. Thank you.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ronnie Edickson. As Peter, you said, this was not part of the AP. It was part of the SCOB committee. However, in the past, we didn't have some discussions on this issue on the AP level. And we always kind of backed off because we were afraid it was kind of complex. We were afraid that it's going to chip away our DCC allocation. And I did support work at the SCOB committee level. But after that, since that meeting, I'm starting to have some reservations because of the timing we have. This would be a better amount of work for the limited resources of the staff to try to time us for the next framework for the habitat amendment. So I do agree there should be some analysis, but I just don't know if the timing is right. So I'm kind of reluctant to 100% support this motion. Thank you.
Are there any other comments from the audience? Seeing none, we're back to the council. Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. if I may, I'd like to provide a little bit of background on this issue since I did make the motion in committee. You know, first of all, the scallop fishery is the Mid-Atlantic's number one fishery in terms of dollar landings. The same holds true for the states at the individual level of Virginia and New Jersey. So for a very long time, it's been our number one fishery. And the performance of the fishery coastwide in recent years, at least from 2009 through 2012, was essentially stable at an excellent level of performance. Landings were in the mid-50 million pound range, and coastwide, during that period of time, landings only decreased 1.5%. During that same period of time in Virginia, landings dropped 43%. You saw some of that information in the landings chart that Deirdre put up. And that was, frankly, before things got bad. You know, it was in 2013 that the overall output in the fishery dropped another 30%. So from 09 to 13, Virginia's landings are down 71%. And that's a precipitous decline. I mean, that's a type of decline that results in community-wide impacts. Now, the underlying performance of individual boats in the fishery hasn't changed on that order of magnitude, but the performance of the fishery relative to landings at the state level has declined very dramatically. This is a complex issue. There are a combination of factors that contribute to that decline in landings at the state level. It's not just this issue, but this disincentive associated with the clock and bringing a trip home is a very big one. On an open area trip, a Virginia boat can't get home off the clock. There's no way to work the demarc line and get all the way home. By contrast, you know, an open area trip that's in the South Channel can get back to New Bedford largely off the clock. Once they get in around Nantucket, they can steam home. The demarc line, you know, wasn't drawn in the interest. I mean, that was never an objective of the way the demarc line was set up to be fair to all the East Coast ports. I would suggest that the days at sea also as a management tool was never intended to advantage or disadvantage specific or individual ports or states. I don't think we really thought of it in any of those terms. It was simply a management tool for trying to manage effort in the fishery and associated output in the fishery. But the reality is that it's having very asymmetrical impacts in the fishery today. You got a feel for that, I think, in some of the information Deirdre put up. But it, you know, the situation right now with respect to the timing of considering this, the impacts are more acute than they've ever been. You have a letter that I distributed today from the city of Newport News that was requested by the harbor master, and she points out that the seafood industrial park in the boat harbor right now has been left barren by this decline in landings. It's really a ghost town. I mean, I've had an office in the boat harbor since 1997, and I've never seen it this bad. So the current situation is acute. It's exacerbated by the timing and coincidence of the rotational access areas, where those have occurred. You know, if a Virginia-based boat's taking a trip in a access area on Georgia's bank, odds are they're going to pack at New Bedford. That's a fact of life. We accept that. There are also fuel disincentives. You have a significant fuel cost associated with bringing trips home. That's an inherent disincentive. Again, that's just part of the business. You know, we accept that. But the one issue that's regulatory that we can at least evaluate and potentially do something about is the way the clock works on transit time coming home. And I acknowledged in the committee meeting that I do have enforcement concerns about this issue, and I don't want to create another loophole that is vulnerable or susceptible to abuse. I have some concerns with the way the clock interacts with demark line right now and the current provisions for shell stocking. So what I suggested in the motion was that if vessels want to take advantage of this transit corridor, that they enter into it, but then they'd be required to return to port and offload their catch. So they can't go in there and shuck off a bunch of shell stock and bounce back into the fishery. That would probably require a new VMS code. So perhaps we could establish a VMS code that was declared out of the fishery, but product on board, so law enforcement would know that vessel has product on board and it is required to return to port. The need to analyze this, I think, is an important one. We've heard concerns from staff about this being a relatively analytically intensive issue, and I would suggest that elements of it are actually fairly simple. I think we can look at the change in landing distributions that have occurred in terms of the understanding the impacts of the status quo. But when we consider the impact on days at sea, I think that's going to be an important part of the analysis. But right now, if we look at the current profile of fishing and steaming, we have fewer than 20 boats in Virginia that are bringing all their open area trips home. And that has to do with the ownership structure of those boats. But if we had 20 boats taking three trips a year and they had a day and a half steaming time, that's about 90 days of steaming time on the return part of the transit total. If you spread that across the fleet, if that were the case, you're talking about a fractional amount of a day. I think at the end of the analysis, we're not going to see a major impact on days at sea allocation of the whole fleet. But what this would do is create an opportunity for a more level playing field, I think, for the fleet, and it would allow vessels, regardless of their port of departure, to access the fishing grounds and then to return to their home port. So, you know, I have enforcement concerns. I think we can address those right up front. And it wasn't part of the motion, but I would further suggest that as we go through it, in the end, we consider not allowing vessels that are in that corridor operating under that code to possess shell stock, because I think the ability of the agency and the Coast Guard to enforce the current limitations on shell stocking are somewhat limited. I mean, it's a difficult thing that requires being on board to enforce that shell stock limit. So, you know, I would suggest that we address those things up front. But we also have a letter. Our council considered this question last Thursday and requested that this be analyzed as part of the framework. I've been on the committee, I think, for 7 years. I think this is the first request we've ever made as a council. But we would request that it be considered for analysis within the framework. Thank you.
John.
I want to speak in support of this. And Chairman Robbins laid out a number of reasons. Jeff Kalin, the seconder of the motion said he thought this might benefit the whole fleet. Yesterday I mentioned something about Happy Talk. I don't think this will benefit the whole fleet. I think there might be winners and losers here. And I think if you look at the graph in Deirdre's presentation, you can see that. And I think Rick alluded to that. But I think this is worthy of going out for analysis for that reason. Because we ought to analyze it for that reason. And as Rick said, it is complicated. It's not just the cost of regulation. There are other factors, gasoline and everything else in this. So you don't know whether a corridor evens out those curves. But, you know, Massachusetts has been winning, and New Jersey and Virginia have been losing. And who knows the different factors at that. But I think when you take a look at community impact in whatever the fishery is, we are concerned about community impact, National Standard 8, and so we ought to look at this. And as Rick said, yes, there are enforcement issues, and that's something that ought to be analyzed as well, whether it's in this proposed corridor or existing demarcation lines. I mean, if it's a concern with a proposed one, it must be a concern with existing ones. So the answer that Rick has proposed for a proposed one, maybe that's something that we should look at with existing ones. But my point is that when you look at the lines of impacts on ports in Deirdre's presentation, that's worthy of our concern. And what we're talking about is analyzing a potential answer. And I agree with Ron Enochson's point that, you know, Tom and all of us have mentioned over and over again, no matter what the issue is, that every proposal takes staff time, and that's always a limited resource, and we need to think about that all the time. But I think this is worthy of being included in this, and so I support this motion.
Mary Beth.
So I think in general people are interested in taking a look at this. I do think, however, that it's not 20 votes. If you look at table 8 in the document, Cape May alone has 73 limited access scallop vessels, and so I think it's an issue clearly in Virginia, but I think if we have a corridor that, you know, boats from other ports are likely to use it as well. Deirdre's concerned about the amount of time here, and I just have a question for NOAA General Counsel. And at, you know, if this is going to have impacts on days at sea allocations, at what point would we need to be concerned about including it in a framework and doing an EIS?
Gene.
I guess we have to know what the specifics are to see what the what the scope of the impacts are. If you're asking an EIS, I mean, that's hard to judge in advance versus an EA. And again, it's not dependent on the type of action. A framework could trigger an EIS, as an amendment could trigger just an EA. So,
to this point, Matt?
Yeah, I think from the perspective of the Science Center, I spoke to Paul Rago about this, and we don't think doing the additional analysis is probably going to be a big problem. And the social sciences branch could also probably provide some, you know, additional support for economic analysis if that were required. But I guess, you know, we'd like Deirdre to provide a little bit more information regarding, you know, what kind of analysis you think is going to be required for this. I think both Paul and I weren't thinking of quite the heavy load for this analysis that you seem to be thinking it's going to require.
Thanks for the opportunity, and believe me, I didn't take it lightly to bump this one to high compared to the others. I, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about it, and mostly I think for this one, it seemed as though, one, we certainly would need to pull enforcement into this topic, which is a little beyond what we normally make time for, or, you know, would this require enforcement committee meetings, you know, meeting with more people within the agency with enforcement? That's a little more beyond what our normal actions would include, and I think we would need to do that for this one, so that was one thing. In terms of the VMS or the data needs, and I appreciate you talked to some people about it already, I feel currently on the Scholar Plan Development Team, we really do not have someone very well versed in using VMS directly themselves. So I would need to look beyond the Scholar PDT, whether it's at the center, at the region, within our own office. I haven't gone and reached out to anyone until this is actually in the framework or not. I don't think it's impossible to, we do it in other actions as well, go beyond our normal Scholar PDT group. But, you know, that is taking them from something else, and I don't have a good feeling right now if the few people I know that can do this kind of work are available. I agree that once we kind of have that in hand and there's, you know, a certain set number of vessels from each of these states, I do think to really look at it completely, you'd have to go back a little further than just the last 2 years. You know, we are in a situation, and it's probably the worst maybe it'll ever be for the ports far to the south, but to really look at how to adjust a day at sea potentially, I think we need to go back further and just, you know, VMS data is pretty hard to work with. So those are the main reasons that I was kind of putting it in that category. And I don't know if you guys were getting specific about VMS data, but there's really, you know, a pretty small group of people that can work on that, and it's beyond the PDT membership.
Tom Neese.
So with respect to complexity, all the discussion seems to be that it's just this corridor is just going to be used by boats going south, you know, fishing on Georges and moving south. I mean, are there any times in the past where the scallop fishing was actually better in the mid-Atlantic area where vessels might want to use this corridor moving north?
Yes. So it's definitely a spatial fishery, and, you know, the vessels move around quite a bit. Most of the time, the access, primarily when you see the boats from the north going to the south, it's in access areas, which is just to make sure everyone on the council's aware, when you go to an access area trip, you're not charged days at sea. So your steaming time to and from Elephant Trunk, for example, or Closed Area 2 is not on the clock. So in those situations, it's not an issue. But yes, and certainly you wouldn't want to predict the future, but there could very well be large sets, and there have been larger sets of scallops in the south around Hudson Canyon and further inshore. You can see from the activity, obviously, there's decent fishing inshore of these areas. And the committee did discuss that this would not be a one-way, and I failed to mention before the other issue I was a little worried about, too, kicking this to high, is that, well, maybe we're going to hear about other corridors, maybe not this specific one, but maybe there's some other smaller corridor that people want to look at. And, you know, maybe we can close the door on that and just look at one to help alleviate some of those concerns. But, there, you know, we might hear about a corridor up to Maine, you know.
Oh, it's a quarter up to Maine. Mike.
Yeah, before Tom asked that question, I was thinking about the early 90s when, in fact, the groundfish close areas, which became the heart of the rotational areas in New England, went into effect with not much attention from the scallopers because basically they were all fishing in the mid-Atlantic at that time. So these things do shift quite considerably. I guess my concern is the workload issue because it seems clear to me, as John said, there will be winners and losers. It's just a question from the analysis whether it's very small winners and very small losers, in which case that probably is fine, or whether they're larger. That is, the impact is reductions in days at sea across the fleet that might be, you know, say 5%, maybe call that large, and less than 5% is small. I don't know what individuals' definitions will be. But it is a workload issue, and I don't think we should proceed unless council members actually are willing to support this sort of corridor if it does show a small impact. I suspect we wouldn't be willing to support it if it shows a large one, but I think we need to get our mind around the realities that this is effectively going to result in winners and losers, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that as long as they're relatively small. But if there's not comfort with at least going forward when the impacts are small, then we shouldn't waste staff time at all. I'll support it because I am willing to see some small changes.
Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say we're basically what Mike ended up with. I'm comfortable with that, and you know, if we did the analysis and it demonstrated that, you know, the impact would be marginal fleet-wide, and that would allow for some of the protections, some of the benefits that that Rick outlined and that it seems the Mid-Atlantic Council believes it would provide, I think we should analyze it. And, you know, it'll take the analysis and time that it takes. And I do think it's frameworkable. We change days at sea and address DMARC line issues in scallop frameworks. So I don't really see that posing a problem later on. But, of course, as Gene said, it will depend on the details of the measures we end up with. But I think this is a good the motion includes a number of sort of good steps to identify the enforcement concerns and close those, you know, close those off before this thing goes live. And, you know, as Rick said, there may be one or two others that could be included as we move forward. But I'm comfortable with the direction of the motion, and I'd be comfortable ending up with this corridor at the end if the analysis bears out its benefits and that those benefits outweigh the costs.
Terry. Mary Beth.
So as I said when I first spoke, I do think there's an interest in seeing some analysis here, but I'm also hearing, you know, Deirdre's concerns. So a question for Deirdre. If, you know, based on some of the discussion we just heard, if the impacts are not significant and people think this was a good idea, I mean, could you, we're scheduled final action on this framework in November. Is it possible, do you think, for the PDT to take that first look and provide information back to the council in September? On that particular high-impact, low-impact analysis?
I think maybe it would be possible for us to come back in September and give you kind of a initial look, so to see if we should continue to pursue it further and more fully analyze it, provided somebody from somewhere can give me these VMS resources. I don't feel comfortable that the PDT currently, you know, the people that I can tap on that I feel as though are on this team, we need a little more from somewhere.
Mary Beth.
So if I could just follow up, I guess that someone from somewhere might be someone at the agency. So perhaps either from the Science Center or the regional office, is that support going to be available to the PDT?
Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can try to, you know, to work with you to get you some support to use that VMS data. So I think, you know, if we just discuss that directly, what the needs are, and I need to consult with my staff, and we might be able to figure out how to get you that support.
That's great. And the only other thing, just so people are aware, not to lose sight of, the scallop benchmark assessment is going on right now. It's coming to a big crescendo here in July. So most of the people I do work with at the center are full press with that until mid-July, just so people are aware. Hopefully the day after that's over, we can start working on this.
Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the comments and concerns that have come out of this discussion, and I also appreciate the sensitivities to the potential impacts on days at sea. I think because of that, the analysis itself will be a very important part of the process and discussion. I would point out that there are already winners and losers under the status quo, and there's clearly a shift in landings under the current management measures that we have in place and under the current system. You know, if you go back and look at what was done with the establishment of the access areas, most of the Mid-Atlantic real estate was converted into access areas. And that was done with the support of the industry in the Mid-Atlantic, recognizing that that was going to be the most productive way to manage the fishery. And so that, you know, that, I think that's fine. That's part of the history. But as we look now at the current operation of the Days at Sea and its implementation and administration, this is an issue that, we think is important to address. But I think the analysis will be an important part of this. If it shows I'd be surprised if it showed a major impact, but if it does, we'll have to address that, and I can appreciate the sensitivities around that. But we, you know, we do see it as a fairness issue as it relates to the implementation of the use of DAS. So I appreciate the council's consideration. Thank you.
Further comments from the council? Okay, seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. It's unanimous, 16-0. Mary Beth?
So those are all the committee motions that I had relative to this framework. And as I stated in the beginning, we have two other items or topics to consider today under scallops, and one is our research priorities. And
Before we move on to RSA, you're going to need to make a motion to initiate the framework.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't have one on my list. So this is not a committee motion, but I will make the motion as the chair that we initiate Framework 26 to the Scallop FMP.
Seconded by Laura. Are there any comments? Seeing none, those support the motion to initiate Framework 26, please indicate so, and it is unanimous, 16-0. Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. moving on now. So we have the research issues to deal with here, and Deidre has a presentation. And I don't know how you feel the best way to proceed is, given the time, perhaps to at least go through her presentation and perhaps questions.
Yeah, let's see. Let's try to get at least that far.
Okay, so I'll turn it over to Deidre.
Thank you. This is actually a relatively short presentation. I just want a couple slides to refresh your memory about the Scallop RSA in general, and then a quick summary of some of the input from the PDT, the advisors, and the committee. So the next presentation is number 10 in your binder. Just a quick background, the Scallop Research Set-Aside Program began officially in 1999. The program has evolved quite a bit over the years. But in general, in more recent times, roughly about 1.25 million pounds of scallop available catch is set aside every single year to fund research projects. Of course, that depends on the value of scallops, which has also changed pretty dramatically since 1999. So that million plus pounds does provide quite a bit of research in terms of dollars in the $10 to $15 million per year range. Granted, most of that total value does go back to the vessels themselves through compensation for the time spent to raise the funds for the research, but at least a good quarter or so of that value does directly go to the research projects themselves. Each year, about 10 to 15 projects are funded annually through the RSA program. And in general, it does vary from year to year, but roughly 5 to 10 different organizations will receive funding depending on the year or the category and what's available. We've also seen a trend in recent years that even some of the organizations that are applying for RSA are collaborating and submitting proposals with other organizations. So even though sometimes it appears as just one organization receiving the funding, in many cases, even in more recent years, it's almost the norm where some of these projects are collaborating with other organizations as well. So generally, this council, at least biennially and more recently every single year, you've been providing the direct research recommendations for these priorities that go into the federal funding announcement for these projects each year. In terms of the topics that are covered through the RSA, again, this does change from year to year, but in general, overall, about half of the funds generally go to support directly scallop resource surveys. For the most part, that is, you know, to look into an access area, determine what the biomass estimate is, to then directly feed into the allocations for that next fishing year. So roughly about half of the funding goes for that purpose directly. You can see the division of the rest. Again, this is a combination of the last 4 years. A lot of research goes toward bycatch and conservation engineering research to reduce bycatch, monitoring of bycatch. There's been quite a bit of funding in the turtle arena in the last few years as the council's been working to address impacts on loggerhead turtles. And finally, quite a bit of research in habitat also has been completed through the RSA program. Right when the committee met in May to review the recommendations for priorities, an announcement was right off the press for the 2014 awards. So we did discuss those at the committee level in more detail, and you can find all this information on the agency's website. But the recent awards for the fishing year 2014 had just been awarded right before the meeting, and there were 16 projects funded for this fishing year, and, you know, almost the full 1.2 million pounds fully allocated. Some of those pounds had been allocated from a previous announcement, and you'll notice that the announcements this year also include some funding into next year's fishing year announcements. So you'll see about 3 million pounds have been awarded already. Lately, we've been doing two-year announcements, and the majority of all the funds for the first year are awarded, and then depending on the different proposals that are submitted, there is the flexibility to award two-year projects as well. So you will see in this year in particular, you know, quite a bit has been funded already from last year's announcement. So these pie charts try to give you a sense of the breakout by topic. Again, this year you'll see there was a decline in the amount of funding towards surveys directly. Now we're a little closer to 40%. And this really directly is coming from an increase in efforts to fund research to look at incidental mortality and discard mortality. If you recall, Council talked a lot about that in the last year or so, trying to get a better handle on the estimates that are based on some pretty old research on this topic. So a lot of funding was kind of put in that category. That's mostly why you see a change in, or a reduction in the survey-supported research. The rest of the topics are pretty similar to how they were or have been funded in previous years in terms of habitat and bycatch and so forth. In terms of organization, again, kind of in that 5 to 10 ballpark, again, there's roughly 8 organizations that were funded directly through RSA awards this year. But again, many of these projects are kind of intertwined in terms of organizations submitting proposals together. So in this process and during this year, the Council has received either through the committee or directly to the Council and the Science Center some correspondence related to the RSA process. Those correspondence are included in your package for today's meeting, and the Executive Director felt that it would be a good time to kind of clarify this process, and we noticed in our handbook or operating procedures, we don't really have a very clear description of the RSA process and how the review and selection process works. So the committee reviewed a draft of this RSA procedure and policy and basically approved it by consensus, I believe, or without objection to approve this policy just to improve transparency. And the idea would be that if the council agrees with the text, which is also document number 5 in your package, it's a quick 2-page summary just to improve awareness of the program and how it works. The idea would be that we would include this in the handbook if the council agrees that that's a good idea. Brief summary of those 2 pages basically in how the council's involved in setting the priorities, but it is this coordinated joint effort between the council and the Science Center. Basically, it is officially a grant that's awarded by NOAA, so there are certain things that need to happen in terms of the review and the selection itself. So those 2 pages kind of describe all of those details. Finally, as I said, the committee did review this text and approved it. Staff from the Cooperative Research Program has also reviewed this text and helped me draft parts of it as well. So they have reviewed and commented on it already. Moving on from the policy, hopefully that will be a quick discussion. Next, we get into the priorities themselves. And the Plan development team met in April to first review the priorities as we normally do. The plan development team provides input initially, and then that goes to the advisory panel and the committee. And the PDT mostly focused on two of the priorities that were identified as new priorities last year by the advisors. The PDT hadn't commented on those specifically yet, so we spent the majority of our discussion, and you can see it in the PDT memo. There's two pages of description of our discussion in terms of suggestions on ways to clarify some of the priorities, a few suggestions about moving things around. I think in general, the plan development team felt that the list is very long, and the more that the committee and advisors and full council could do in terms of prioritizing them may help the selection process to be a little more clear about what the true priorities are of the council. The list is, you know, longer than 20 items. So there's a quick description of the different things. Many of the suggestions from the PDT are pretty basic, just clarifying text issues as well, but they are described on the screen. Following month, these were forwarded to the advisors and the committee, and they had a meeting in mid-May. Again, very long discussions. Both groups spent a lot of time talking about priorities. You can get a sense of the discussion from the two meeting summaries that are also included in your package. Both groups really spent a lot of time talking about priorities. In general, what's described on the screen are kind of the take-home suggestions from ultimately the committee. I'll just note the major ones, really, and what did take a lot of discussion at all levels was in terms of overall priority, all groups felt that doing a kind of holistic, broad-scale survey is important for an RSA announcement, and it is a priority, but a lot of the discussion is where should it fall on the list. And ultimately, the recommendation from the committee was to put it as high priority, the number one priority, equal with two other types of survey priorities, including access areas and potentially new candidate scallop access areas. So in general, if it isn't clear, I apologize. The suggestion is all scallop survey work have equal priority and it be the number one priority overall. The second priority should be related to bycatch. And finally, the third priority would be projects related to other area rotation issues such as predation, seeding, et cetera. And you can see all of this. There is a separate document, number six, that includes all of the final committee recommendations for the priorities. There were some suggestions from the advisors to move a couple other things around, and they had one new suggestion. We do have a couple instances recently with very large recruitment events, so there was a suggestion to include a new priority that would seasonally, more than once a year, take a look at some of these large recruitment events and get a better handle on how they're surviving and what's going on to get someone to go out there a couple times a year. So that's a new suggestion. And then I won't go through all of these, but they spent a lot of time suggesting moving things upper and lower based on things that were either funded recently that we'd rather wait and see what kind of results come out of those projects before more projects are funded. So in the end, it's a very long list. There was a lot of moving that went on, and the final suggestions are all laid out in document number six. And there is a motion, finally, from the committee to approve those as you see them in document number six. There was an attempt to try to shorten the list and basically just get rid of the ones under other, but ultimately the committee decided not to do that and just leave the laundry list on there for now, recognizing that funds are going to run out before you get down to those lower topics, most likely, especially now that the committee has gone and basically prioritized five things as, you know, the highest. Most likely, you know, we're not going to get too much further beyond those, provided there are good projects that are submitted for those topics. And then finally, in all of this discussion of the RSA priorities, the committee did pass a consensus statement. This did come up. I'll briefly explain it in more detail. There is, as you mentioned on the first day of this meeting, a large meeting scheduled for March 2015 that the Science Center has agreed to convene basically an independent review of all of the various survey methods that we use in this region in terms of there is a draft terms of reference that has been developed, and this meeting is scheduled for March 15th. The committee talked and recognized the issue that well, a lot of the awards for next year are going to have to be given before that meeting happens, and this is unfortunate, and we're stuck in this place, and what should we do about it? So they basically passed this committee statement urging the center to try to hold that meeting sooner, if possible, so that those results from that important meeting could be available and integrated into the selections and awards for the following RSA proposals. Whether that's feasible or not, you know, we can see as the discussion goes on. But this is a consensus statement from the committee to make that request.
Thank you, Dieter. Are there questions from the council on her presentation? Tom. Are there any questions from the audience? Okay, seeing none, back to the council. Mary Beth.
So as Deidre indicated, the committee approved the new policy by consensus, but I do think for our process here, it might be a little cleaner to make a motion. So this is not a committee motion, but I do make a motion that the council approve the draft policy statement for the research set aside, that is document number 6.
Seconded by Laura. Are there any comments from the audience? Ron.
Ron Smolitz, Fishery Survival Fund. Right now, I don't necessarily want to discuss the priorities. I want to discuss the process, which is, I think, what we're discussing here. I didn't realize that we had a problem in the prioritization, and it's a significant problem. At the end of the committee meeting, I had a discussion with Earl Meredith at the back of the room. And it was brought on, for example, by the turtle issue, in that we moved turtle research from high priority in the scallop fishery to medium priority, and because we solved our turtle interaction process. And right now we spend about 5% of the RSA funds, scallop RSA funds, monitoring the turtles, and that's why I sort of brought up the turtle issue. We're talking about changing boundary lines. The RSA doesn't only support our at-sea research on turtles. It also is the mechanism that allows the Science Center to use their AMAPS funds to go out and do research on turtles. It's also the mechanism for the Virginia Aquarium to go out and do research on turtles. And Earl said, well, you know, it almost didn't get approved this year. And I said, huh? It has good reviews. Well, apparently 25 points, the technical reviewers, 25 points are looking at the priority list that the council sets. So automatically in the beginning of the process, even though it gets great technical reviews, the reviewers have to reduce the proposal because it's not high priority in points. By the time it gets to the management review, it's down the list because you have all these higher priority surveys and bycatch work and other work. And the lawyers in the grants program won't allow them to go down and reach for other proposals if you have all these other proposals above it. So even though it's an extremely important work that needs to be done, and it's only 5% of the RSA funding, there's a good chance, because it's of a lower priority, that it won't get done. So thinking about that, I said, well, we're spending a lot of money this year looking at discard mortality and incidental mortality. If I had a dredge design that reduces discard mortality, it's not even on the priority list. So even if I put in a great proposal to look at discard, how to reduce discard mortality, it would not get funded because it would have such, it would start off at a tremendous handicap, where even if the management committee thought it was a great idea, they wouldn't be able to reach down and get it. So that's a process issue, and there are a number of ways to deal with that. One is in a solicitation, don't put 25 points towards looking at the priority list and allow the technical reviewers to rate the proposals on what their thoughts are relative to priority, and then have the management review process work with the priority list so that these proposals don't come into the management review process handicapped. Or say that there are certain things, they might not be high priority, but they should be done. A certain amount of resources, that's a little bit more complicated. And that's one of the problems of having a system that is competitive versus a contract, subcontract type of system. But so while the program has been working well, we need to look at things. And the other thing is the survey issue, which is, again, mentioned that we need to convene a meeting next March to look at the relative merits of the different survey technologies. That really isn't the issue from the perspective of the RSA. It's the question of how many overlapping surveys need to be done. We don't need outside experts. We have enough expertise between the Science Center, our academic partners, and the fishing industry to sit down in November and see what type of mix of surveys and how important it is to have overlap. We've funded, in some cases, four surveys overlapping the same area at different scales. That's the issue that needs to be addressed. And we could address that in-house. We don't have. I had a Paul Rago called me last week one night to discuss.
Hey, Ron,
this.
Can you summarize your points? Peter.
Thank you. Peter Hughes, Atlantic Cape Fisheries. I'll be brief. I just wanted to really discuss the consensus statement at the bottom of slide number 8, that we do have this meeting earlier rather than later so that all of our partners, National Marine Fisheries Service, Science Center, academia, and industry stakeholders can be all on the same page when it comes to surveys. So I'd like to emphasize this consensus statement at the bottom of slide number 8. Thank you.
Other comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. John?
I am supportive of this. It's really a question I have of Deirdre on the priorities, and that is, I think the RSA program is a tremendous program, and I love to brag about how the scallop industry funds such a significant amount of research and how they also look very far down the road and how important that is. And while I'm not a scientist, the thing that worries me most about the health of the, or long-term health of the industry, is ocean acidification. And I note that that was moved down on the list, and it says here in this brief slide, move longer-term ocean acidification projects lower. And I don't know whether ocean acidification is longer term, whether it's a longer term issue or not, but it would seem, even if it is longer term, that beginning it, looking at it sooner, would be fairly important. But I just wondered, Deirdre, what the discussion was on that issue, why that was moved down.
Deirdre, before you answer John's question, I'd like to kind of keep the council focused on the motion on the board, which is different than the actual priorities. So are there council comments on the motion on the board? Mike?
Yeah, I will not support it. I'll vote no. I don't want to go into details, but my bottom line is I think that we are not getting as much out of the opportunity from the research set aside as we might because we are constraining our process by NOAA grants. And I'm not criticizing NOAA grants. We've made the decision to use that as the funding vehicle. And I think there are many things that would be better handled by some other funding mechanism. I won't elaborate, but I've held that view for a long time and expressed it in various places, and I think at some stage it would be worth digging into it in some detail. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
So a question. I mean, the policy, perhaps for Tom or Deirdre, the policy is descriptive of how we currently do the program. And Mike had brought up this concern at the committee meeting, and I think he knows much more about it than I do, certainly, of how these things could, you know, could operate. I don't think that passing the motion, however, really ties our hands to looking at future better ways, and we can change the policy, I think. But I would ask for some just thoughts from Dieter or Tom on that.
Tom.
Right. I agree with everything you said, Mary Beth. You know, the problem we have right now is we have a research set-aside program that's in place, and I don't think there's anywhere that documents how it works. And so the goal here was an attempt to try and document how it works at present. And, you know, if the council thinks that this is not the way we should go, we can always sit down and try and work through it and revise the policy. But we felt at the time that because of some of the questions we got this year and because of some of the miscommunication that went on this year with the policy, we thought it would be helpful to have a document written that at least lays out the steps that we're currently following.
Other comments on the motion on the board? Seeing none, Jim.
I just wanted to clarify, there's a statement in Deirdre's handout at the end that starts with by consensus, and it refers to the timing of the survey methods review. This will be talked about after this. That's not part of the thank you.
With that clarification, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed, the motion carries 15 to 1. It's just about 12 o'clock, so let's take an hour's break, and we're going to go back to John's question to Dee once the motion is back up on the board.